Today, I'm chatting with my friend, licensed marriage and family therapist, Tony Overbay, and we're combining my favorite topics, which are marriage and health. This interview went a little bit long, but it's so good. So without further ado, here it is. Hello and welcome to On the Brighter Side. I'm your host, Monica Tanner, and I'm really excited about my guest today. He was one of the very favorite presenters from the Epic Marriage Summit. He's one of my favorite podcasters and just all around awesome guy. He is a licensed marriage and family counselor who practices in California. Please help me welcome Dr. Tony Overbay. Hey, Tony, how are you doing today?
I'm just grinning over here the entire time. You're very kind in saying that I was one of your favorite presenters. That is so nice because I felt inadequate. You had such big names on the panel and that was such a neat experience and I was grateful to be a part of that. But I'm so happy to be on the podcast. Thank you, Monica.
Oh, well, I'm so happy that we finally got you on the podcast. It wasn't an easy task, but you combine, or what we're going to talk about today, combines two of my favorite subjects of all time, marriage and fitness or health. So yeah.
Anybody ask me these things together, really, on an interview, so I'm kind of pumped too. I'm a little worried I'm going to get a bit verbose. So I want your listeners to know that beforehand, you know, you basically have freedom to say, hey, dial it back, Tony, right? Because I could go on and on.
I just won't even tell you. I'll just edit out the stuff.
Oh, that's funny. Okay, that's even better. That's even better. Okay.
It'll be perfect. Let's start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your family because you didn't really get that opportunity on the summit. So introduce yourself and then talk about your family for a little bit.
Sure. I've been married for 29 years and it is to my high school sweetheart. So I don't know if you have the aw, you know, that you can put in there as well. Yeah. And we met I met her when she was in 8th grade. I was in 9th grade and I dated two of her friends. And finally, I kind of wisened up and made the right choice. And I got my undergraduate degree at the University of Utah. So I grew up in Utah. And then we headed out west to California. I actually came out here. It was back. I'm an old man. I just turned 50, Monica. So I was here before the dot-com boom. I worked in software. I thought I was going to, you know, be a multimillionaire a couple of times, but as did everyone prior to the dot-com boom. And that didn't work out. And so during that 10 years of working in high tech, I really didn't even realize. It's one of those I didn't know what I didn't know, but I really wasn't very satisfied with my career. And I had always enjoyed reading people. And I know a lot of people that hear this kind of thing, but I typically could find somebody that really wanted to open up and share their story with me. I really enjoyed that part. So I had an opportunity to travel and meet a lot of people that decade in software, but it just really didn't feel very fulfilling. And I felt a call. I felt a call to go back, get a master's in counseling and work with men. And I apologize if anybody's heard any other interviews where I maybe talked about this, but the joke is that I felt very passionate. I loved everything about studying counseling, getting my master's, but then I show up to be a therapist and men don't typically come into counseling on their own. So that led me to doing more work with addiction where, you know, I did get to see a fair amount of men and the addiction part, I started to quickly realize anybody can teach behavioral skills, but I started realizing that the addiction was really, I felt it was a void. You know, I felt that men had a void. They didn't feel connected in their marriages, in their careers, as a parent, in their faith, in their health. We're going to get to that one big time today, right?
Yeah.
And so then I started trying to find all these nice ways to work with each one of those areas. And then that just kind of fast forward and 15 years in a private practice later. And I love what I do. I mean, I absolutely love what I do. So I have four wonderful children, 21, 19, 17, and 15. My oldest is married. I have an amazing son-in-law. So far, all that stuff's pretty easy. And I think that kind of brings us up to today.
Awesome. Well, you didn't talk about your wife much, but we will. So
okay. I have to tell you though, my wife is so funny. I get more emails about, hey, have your wife on, you know, why don't you interview your wife? I beg her to come on the podcast. I think we might've joked about that even on our last time we spoke.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you can get her to come on, Monica, that would be amazing.
Well, likewise right. With my husband, people really want to hear from him, but this is not his jam. So he stays far away. He claps from the background.
He's incredible though. So it looks like this is a setup, but I have a new book. I have a book that just came out and I had to write the acknowledgments part. And I don't know if anybody ever reads the acknowledgments.
Right.
Sometimes I do. But can I just read you one quick thing?
100%.
All right. Yes. So this is out of the acknowledgments in a book that I just had that just came out. And I say right out of the gate, I am so grateful to my wife, Wendy, for her continuous support. And I'm grateful for my kids. They put up with family home evening meetings where I would begin the question, so when's the last time you guys saw pornography? You know, because the book's about helping people overcome pornography addiction and betrayal trauma. But here's where I just said, I love that you asked this question. I said, back to Wendy. She was right there beside me for the 10 years I spent in a career I truly did not not feel a passion for. She was the first one to encourage me to go back to school at the age of 32 with four small children at home. She is truly the coolest person in every room, the rock, the one who can help bring me back to center when my imposter syndrome is screaming. Without Wendy's support, I never would have pursued the career change that re-energized me in a way I never dreamed of. Without her encouragement and support, I never would have started a podcast that now has over 2 million downloads and has helped more people than I ever could imagine. Without her support, I wouldn't have created a recovery program that has thankfully changed lives. And then without those two things, I never would have been in a position to interview the person who then brought this book project to me. So I just feel like my wife is really, she is the rock and the foundation. So thanks for asking that.
That's incredible. I think we should start a friendly wager.
Yes.
Let's see who can get our spouse on our podcast sooner.
I want to. So, okay, let's do it. I'm competitive. Let's do it.
All right. Okay. We get bragging rights.
Does the podcast have to be aired or could it just be recorded?
No, it has to be aired. The first one to air an episode with their spouse gets total bragging rights.
All right. I'm in.
Okay, cool. So what you did mention is that you and your wife are both long distance runners. I've had some amazing experiences training for 3 marathons and I'm not done yet. I think I will still do a couple more, but talk to us about your love of running and where this passion came from.
So I really am giddy to talk about, I've never talked about this stuff before. So, you know, I wasn't a runner in high school. I 100% have a story of, I ran one day of cross country when I was trying to get in better shape. I played baseball in high school and basketball. And on the first day, I realized, man, this is really hard. And this is the truth. I faked an ankle injury. We were running on, I remember it was Indian Hills Middle School. We went over there and we were running fartlek trainings and, you know, where the guy in the back would go up to the front. And we're about 10 minutes in and I thought, this is horrible. So I totally faked an ankle injury and then I never ran cross country again. And then when I was in my 20s, I put on a little bit of that college weight and I started running. And I still remember when running 2 or 3 miles, I felt like it was an amazing thing. I remember my first 10K in Sacramento around the zoo. And I remember my first half marathon up in Tahoe and it absolutely killed me. And then my very first marathon ever, I didn't train well. This was before the internet. I didn't fuel. I even tried to not eat for a few days before so I would feel light on my feet. I mean, it was ridiculous. And we had no kids. My wife was there at mile 13. And this is I'm so excited to tell these stories. And I come into the half marathon mark. My wife we have a brand new golden retriever. I mean, it was like a picture of just everything you've ever dreamed of. And I come in there and my legs had just fused straight. I mean, I couldn't move. And she's like, I'll see you at the finish. And I was like, oh no, I'm done. You know? And so this is all true. I hobble over. There was a Taco Bell right off of the course and I hadn't eaten in a couple days. I'm just miserable. And so I waddle in there and I've got my bib number on, whatever. She had given me a couple of bucks. I got a breakfast burrito. I ate it and I just promptly turned around and then threw it up right outside. And I was like, I'm done. So there's my first marathon experience, Monica.
Wow.
So I came back the next year and had fun, finished it and then chased a whole bunch of marathons until I got a nice Boston qualifier, probably did another 10 or 15 more. And then after about 40 or 50 marathons, I bumped up to the ultra marathon level. And then I think I've done 100 or more of those. So my love of running has just been, it's been there probably since my mid to late 20s. You know, never really been the fastest. Man, I just love it. It is such a tranquil, happy place to me that I think that's what kind of kept leading me to longer and longer distances because it just was such a finding my zen moments over and over again.
Yeah, I love that. So my story of running is not actually very similar, but
no Taco Bell burrito throw ups.
No, that never happened to me, but I was a soccer player in high school. And so there was a lot of running involved there. And I thought that I would play soccer in college, but I tore my ACL my senior year.
Oh no.
So that dashed all my dreams. It was fine. I got into a great school and had a great experience. My freshman year, I started out and totally overzealous, was taking a lot of hours, a lot of courses. And I remember just getting to the point where my body just I had a hard time waking up. I had a hard time staying awake. I just was starting to get lethargic and having a hard time staying awake studying. And so I remember calling my dad and telling him what was going on. And he was like, well, what are you doing for exercise? And I was who has time to exercise? I'm in college, dad. And he was like, you've got to do something. You've got to get out there. And here I was, this totally poor college student. I was like, what kind of exercise am I going to do? And so my dad was like, well, maybe you should get a pair of tennis shoes and just run. And I thought,
never thought of that.
Huh?
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, not my roommate, but one of my dorm mates, just like across the hall, was a big runner too. And so I was like, hey, next time you go out for a run, I want to go with you. And we had the most beautiful course. It was around campus. And then the capital of Texas, which is in Austin, was just right across from campus. And so you could run downtown and run from the Capitol building to the UT Tower. And I mean, it was just gorgeous, picturesque. So I started loving running. And in Texas, you can run year round.
Oh, yeah.
So that became my exercise of choice. I also did find the student gym, which was pretty amazing and high tech. So I enjoyed working out there. And so, of course, my mood changed, my energy level changed, everything changed for me. I realized it was a non-negotiable. I always needed to do something.
Can I ask you, do you remember how long it took you before you really felt like it was you? I mean, do you feel like you struggled with it for quite a while, or did you find that you fell in love with it right away?
You know, for me, it was hard to get myself motivated to just go. But since I had a partner who was like kind of depending on me, I started to love it for that high. When you get to about mile 3 or so, something just happens. And back then, I think we had like Walkmans or Discmans, and it wasn't easy to run. It's not like you had a phone or a little tiny iPod or something to run with. I mean, you were carrying a big old piece of machinery if you wanted to run with music. And so when I started running, it was like me with my thoughts. And I remember I would work out all kinds of problems. Yeah. I would figure out all of the secrets of the universe as I was running. And I really got addicted to all of that, to having that time to myself to just ponder and figure out, you know, what the next step was, what I was working towards, all of those things. I just really, and then of course the physical just sensation of getting a good workout and sweating and those things all just were very addicting to me.
Can I bust one pop psychology myth that I love busting all the time, and especially when it comes to running, is there's that theory, or that we've all heard it, where 21 days to make a habit. And so I find a lot of people that they get to the 21 days and they say, I still don't really like it, so it must not be for me. Hmm. And so long ago, one of the first podcasts I did was kind of sharing that's actually just, it's a pop psychology myth. And I don't, do you know much about that one? Or 21 days, it was a plastic surgeon, I believe it was Maxwell Maltz, who was in World War I, I believe. I want to say World War I, I think it was World War II. But he went along with the troops, and so he noticed that when they would lose a limb, that they would feel like they had the limb there for about 21 days on average. So he posted he wrote a research paper that said that. So all the psychologists took that data and said, well, that must mean that it takes 3 weeks for the brain to kind of create this. Now it knows that limb's not there and move forward. Well, it's a completely different experience than trying to learn how to run or trying to learn how to juggle or whatever it is, or read the classics. And so there's so much data now that shows that it can take even from 3 months to 6 months for something to really feel like a habit. So I feel like with exercise, and this is why I do, I was thinking about this one when you had asked me to come on today. I thought that as a marathon runner, as an ultra marathon runner, and then as a therapist, that I would be able to encourage every one of my clients. I mean, we would be running in masses, and we would be, you know, all doing marathons and races. And it's been very few clients that I've had that have actually then really took on and embraced running. And I find that one of those, you know, people, they struggle trying to find the time or the confidence or that sort of thing. But I feel like a lot of people just, they don't stick with it long enough, and it does hurt, and it isn't very fun at times, right? I'm grateful to hear that for you, it just became a non-negotiable, because I feel like sometimes we just have to say, okay, I'm going to do this, and kind of power through.
Yeah. Well, it worked out really great for me, because when I met who would eventually be my husband, our first like maybe 10 dates were all like just running together.
Oh, wow.
We were just running buddies, and then we became life partners.
So yeah. That's nice.
It worked out really well.
Well, don't you feel like you do get a lot of, I mean, I love running with my wife, and I love we just talk, and we just observe, and we laugh, and we don't say anything. And there's so much time that's just the two of you, right?
Yeah. It is really wonderful. And I know that as I've run over the years, now, of course, I can take my phone with me and listen to my favorite podcast. Yeah. Before it was my favorite music. But when I do actually just go out, don't take my phone and just run, I have discovered so many metaphors for every aspect of life in running. So have you noticed something similar? I feel like I've worked through all of life mysteries running. Like there's just something that happens when you're moving your body and using your brain at the same time. It just...
Well, there's a lot of good data behind that, actually. I mean, that's where, you know, people are starting to do even yoga and therapy, or walk and talk therapy. Yes. So there is more and more data that shows that movement is very... I agree. And I always say that same thing, where I feel like I've worked out all kinds of things on the trails or on the roads around my house. Sometimes I don't quite remember what those things are, but in those moments, they feel really good. And I love, because you had kind of talked about this or asked this question, I think even when we had spoken at the marriage summit, and I've thought about it a lot, because I feel like there are so many metaphors, everything from just continuing to show up every day, or how things are often easier when you have someone else involved. You know, I'm a huge marriage therapist, you know, emotionally focused therapy. We want to secure attachment with someone. You know, we want somebody that is our person, that is going to be there, who is going to have empathy, who's going to listen, and those sort of things. But I'll tell you, one of the ones that I think I feel like in hindsight, what drew me to the longer and longer distances was, I remember, well, and I'd love to hear your stories about, have you hit the wall on your marathons? runs. I mean, have you hit that proverbial wall?
Oh yeah. Right? And it's typically, I make my husband, because he's never run a marathon with me. A half marathon is his distance. Well, it's the farthest he will run alongside of me.
Yeah.
But I strategically place him where I know I'm going to struggle the most. And then he comes in and runs the end of the whatever race it is with me,
Perfect.
Whether it's 6 miles or however much I need him. And sometimes he runs the race with his hand right on the small of my back and just kind of whispering my ear the whole time, you can do it. You can do this.
I love that. So I love that concept of, you know, I remember looking at the science of the wall, you know, it's when your glycogen stores deplete and all of a sudden you're burning muscle or whatever that is. And I remember just starting to kind of mentally amp up for the wall. And when I was just doing the marathon distance, you know, 26 miles. And then I remember when I first started doing ultra marathons, which is anything over 26 miles. So there's the 50Ks, which are like 32, or there's 50 milers or 100Ks or 100 milers or 24 hour events. But I started realizing, I don't know, there's something just empowering about hitting a wall, getting through the wall, and then getting to a better spot again for a while, and then hitting another wall, and then getting through that wall. And I really became, maybe addicted is too strong of a word, although I don't think it is, but I feel like I almost became addicted to that. Okay, bring on that next wall. You know, and in some of these races where I've gone 100 miles and you're going through the woods and all of this sort of thing, man, it's amazing how you can have this, you know, from mile 30 to 35, I feel like, why am I doing this? I'm never going to do it again. And then 35 to 42, I figure, look, I've got this thing figured out. I'm going to do this forever, you know, and just, oh, I just love that concept. And to kind of speak to what you're talking about, which I love too. So on the longer races in particular, you're allowed a pacer anytime, usually on the 100 milers, it's anytime after 50 miles or there's pacer. And I always have my wife the last 20 miles or so. And that, man, I mean, it will make me get emotional, but some of my favorite moments are the 8 miles, 80 to 100 of ultra marathon, when we're maybe watching the second sunrise come up. We've been with each other for a few hours. We're both just energy depleted, sleep depleted, and just then finishing this thing together. I mean, it literally just, I mean, I bawl like a baby every time, but I love just that we can get through hard things. I love that get through the hard thing and there's good times ahead. You know, I love all of that about racing or about marathons, running in general.
Yeah, I love that. And when you were talking about hitting the wall and then getting that burst of energy again after getting through that, that so goes along with marriage. Because I know, I mean, there's no two people that are going to agree 100% of the time. I mean, that's just not realistic.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, being married for long periods of time, you all of a sudden you get to this place where you're like, oh, like you're just at odds with each other, or you're just not agreeing on something, or something's just really hard to go through. And you get through that, and it's like the most amazing feeling. What comes afterwards, you become stronger having gone through that.
So you inspired me to think of this one thing in particular. So in some of the core principles of the marriage therapy that I love, the emotionally focused therapy, this EFT, is you're kind of going into your relationship knowing that neither one of you wakes up in the morning and thinks, what can I do to hurt my partner? In addition to that, if I'm putting something out there, I have to realize that, okay, my partner, I want to know why they're asking this question or why they feel the way they do, because I care about them. So that's where I'm going to say, hey, tell me more about that. So I was thinking about this because when my wife paces me, let's just say I was thinking about one race in particular, and she picked me up about mile 78. So she was going to go the last 22 with me. And I had a little bit of stomach issues, a little bit of chafing issues, you know, some of these kind of fun things that you get in a race of that length. And I just remember, you know, my wife would say, hey, you know, maybe it's time to have another gel, or have you used the Glide in a little while, or some baby powder, whatever it is. And I remember thinking back on that race, and I remember just saying, okay, I trust her. I mean, that's my person. That's my girl. And so when she came on, Chris had handed me off the Wendy. He just said, okay, Tony, this is who you're going to trust. And I just remember feeling just so empowered by that. So when Wendy said, time to take a gel, I'm like, yeah, because she knows she has my best interest in mind. You know, when she would say, hey, I think you can give me a little more on this flat, I'm like, yes, I can. You know, and I just remember thinking about, that's like that. That's in marriage. If my partner is putting something out to me, you know, I want to know why. I trust that it's not meant to hurt me, and I want to know more. And so I remember at one point saying to Wendy, I don't want to have another gel right now, you know, and it's like she's saying that, man, I know, I can understand that, but I feel like you haven't had a lot of calories in the last hour or so. And so it's like, okay, she heard me, you know, she empathized with me, and then she kind of shared her thoughts. And I'm like, yep, you're right. And I just love those metaphors. They really are there all throughout a race.
Yeah. So in your experience in working with couples in therapy, talk up to us about like training schedules, injuries, proper nutrition, weather conditions. I feel like you can relate all of those things to some aspect of marriage. So have you seen that?
Yeah, a lot. I was thinking about this too. So one of the things is just, you know, if you're going to sign up for a race, I feel like for the most part, you are going to put in the work. Even if you're not perfect at it, you're going to try to find a training plan. You're going to try to learn what you can about nutrition or the best gear or those sort of things. And I mean, this question kind of blew me away the more I thought about it, because I feel like I get couples in my office that say, our marriage isn't going well. And I tell them, hey, here's a couple of books about emotionally focused therapy. Here's a few podcasts. podcasts that I've done on it. Here's some other areas that you can go read about it. But I feel like then they don't go do the work. And I know life is busy, but I feel like, you know, people will come back a week later and they're saying, well, we didn't really get to read the book. And, you know, I haven't really listened to the podcast. And I feel like they're basically just wanting me to say, hey, can you just tell my spouse that they're the ones that are doing things wrong? And then can we just get this done? Because you're kind of expensive and we just need to get this going. And I thought about, man, but when somebody signs up for a race, they're in. You know, they're looking for the training program and training schedule. They're reading forums to see what, you know, what do I do in this situation or this situation? I remember running this 100K on the coast and it rained. It was 9-10 hours of just downpour. And I remember the night before I went and bought my first really sweet rain jacket. I mean, I did everything I could because I was invested in this race. And I thought, man, why are we not doing everything we can if we're invested in our marriage? And so I love that question. So talk about training plans and nutrition and those sort of things. If you're going to commit to improving your relationship, then wouldn't it be the same idea to read the books and, you know, to do the homework your therapist recommends? If you feel inspired about something you hear on one, you know, your podcast or my podcast, don't just think, man, that'd be kind of neat. You know, go do it. And so I feel like we are willing to put that in for a $50 race fee or at the prospects of getting the t-shirt, or in my case, on these 100 milers, everybody likes to give out a belt buckle for some reason. But yet we've got a marriage that we're talking about. And sometimes we're like, yeah, I'm a little too busy to read a book. So that's a great question.
It is crazy. It's totally crazy. I know. I feel like my choice of distraction, I love listening to music or podcasts, but sometimes I run in silence, and listening to my own thoughts has a direct parallel to my interpersonal relationships. And I know the world is so noisy and everybody thinks that they're so busy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that podcast, and that's the music, and that's the things you put in your ear to distract yourself from running. But you could put all of those things away and focus on your relationship. Talk about the importance of that for a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like that. I like that exactly. So it really depends on what are we, you know, there's this concept in acceptance and commitment therapy, which is another modality that I absolutely love. And it's cognitive fusion. Fusion is when you fuse to a thought or idea and then you believe it and you believe that is the truth. But typically we fuse to just a thought. And the thing is, we got thoughts going through our minds all the time. So if we really need to learn how to live by our value, you know, if our value is this connection, if our value is being able to be there for somebody, if our value is reciprocity, if, you know, I want to be able to give and I also want to be able to receive, we need to figure out those values, because then we're less likely to just fuse to these ideas of the, oh, I'll do it tomorrow story and that our brain likes to create, or the I don't have enough time, or those sort of things. Because we can find those thoughts going through our head all the time. And if we fuse to them, you know, then we really do feel like, well, you know, I'll do it later, or I don't have enough time. We need to learn how to kind of just sit with those feelings or emotions and wait for that thought kind of go, and let's see which one comes next. The one that might be a little more uncomfortable, but it might be, man, we have to do something about our marriage. And so we have to sit down and we have to create this time to talk. And a lot of times with my clients, I mean, it doesn't have to be a swing for the fences, all or nothing kind of an event too. I like to say at times, just carve out 15 minutes, maybe 3 days a week, and jot down a few notes of what you recognize, what you noticed throughout the day. And I'm just talking about, hey, this experience happened to me, or I saw this on the news. What do you think about it? I mean, we're just trying to have some communication. I mean, we got to be able to start somewhere. But that cognitive fusion thing, I think, is what can be really hard, because we do start to just hear, or we see a thought, we latched onto the thought, we buy into the thought 100%. And then we kind of go, well, that's who I am. That's what I can do. You know, I'm not good at talking to my spouse. Well, we're fusing to that I'm not good at talking to my spouse story. You know, let's kind of learn how to defuse. Let's learn how to find tools that allow us to talk to our spouse, and then be willing to kind of sit and then, you know, commit the time to be able to learn how to talk to our spouse. Again, we don't have to jump into the deep end and say, hey, tell me all your deepest emotional thoughts. We can just start to say, let's just start to talk again. You know, let's start to kind of have this verbal connection.
So I can't even imagine a 50 miler or a 100 miler, but I have finished a few marathons.
I love it.
And that feeling when you're done, when you cross the finish line, and like all of the sudden, all of the body fluid, I mean, you're just, it's like that feeling of just pure gratitude. Like, I did something amazing. You cry, sometimes you pee a little. I mean, it's like the most incredible feeling. And I know when I'm running, you know, you're running and you're like, this is hard. I don't like this. It's uncomfortable. My muscles hurt. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be so easy for me to just stop. Like, nobody's going to be upset if I just stop running, go off the course, but then you wouldn't experience that feeling at the end. At any moment, you always have the choice to give up, to throw in the towel and to stop, but you wouldn't get that incredible reward at the end. And that, I think, for me, is the biggest metaphor to marriage that I can possibly think of. Sometimes it's uncomfortable, and sometimes you're in pain and you just have to work so hard through all of these physical and mental and emotional struggles. But it's that feeling at the end And to me, that is worth all of it.
You are so dead on. And I just looked up. I love this concept of in acceptance and commitment therapy. There's a book called The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris. And I don't know why I'm showing you because I know this is an audio podcast, but I've got this section highlighted that I just want to talk about. And it talks about what is that exactly is happiness. And they give two different definitions. And I think that you and I are on the same page for the second definition. They say that the word happiness has two very different meanings. The common meaning of the word is to feel good. So in other words, feeling a sense of pleasure or gladness or gratification. And we all enjoy these feelings, so it's no surprise we chase them. However, like all human emotions, feelings of happiness don't last. No matter how hard we try to hold on to them, they slip away every time. And as we shall see, a life spent in pursuit of just those good feelings is, in the long term, deeply unsatisfying. In fact, the harder we chase after pleasurable feelings, the more likely we are to suffer from anxiety and depression. So here's what I love about this. The other far less common meaning of happiness is living a rich, full, and meaningful life. So when we take action on the things that truly matter deep in our hearts, we move in directions that we consider valuable and worthy, clarify what we stand for in life, and act accordingly, then our lives become rich and full of meaning and meaningful, and we experience a powerful sense of vitality. And it's not a sense of some sort of fleeting feeling. It's a profound sense of a life well lived. And here's what I love what you talked about. It says, and although such a life will undoubtedly give us many pleasurable feelings, it will also give us uncomfortable ones such as sadness and fear and anger. This is only to be expected because if we live a full life, then we'll live the full range of human emotion. And I feel like it's that simple concept of it's easy to just sit there on the couch and watch Netflix and eat cookies. That's that first meaning of happiness. It brings us some joy, but that joy is fleeting. The cookies are done. The Netflix series is over. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, where else am I going to find joy, right? Or happiness.
Yes.
But that second one is going out and just having these experiences and feeling this whole wealth of emotion because I am with you. I cried after the very first marathon I finished and it came out of nowhere and I've done it 150 other times. And it's just such a profound feeling of all the work that goes into it, the ups, the downs, the highs, the lows. But man, what a journey and what things that you've learned throughout that. Learned about things that you never thought you could do. Learned about getting through multiple of these walls. Learned about your nutrition. Learned about hydration. Learned so many things. And I've had so many different experiences where I've had these races where, I remember there was one in particular that I broke my hand about 3 days before and I didn't realize I had broke my hand. So my hand was a little bit swollen. And then I went and I flew to a different area actually, and I went out and I did that one and I was, and my hand was like just throbbing and it was getting larger and larger. And that was one that I had a string of really, really successful marathons. And that one I ended up walking about probably 8 or 9 miles because I didn't realize all the blood would go to my broken hand. So then my legs would cramp. And all of a sudden I'm walking a lot. But I used that one to just, I became the guy that was just trying to crack jokes. Everybody that running by me, if I ever did have a little bit of a pick me up, trying to spur others on. And it ended up just being, I tried to be as present as I could. I've got a really cool picture of crossing the finish line. My hand looks like it's ginormous. And I went home and ended up getting a cast. And so now I've got a really cool story of I ran a marathon with this broken hand. Or it's a really dumb story, I guess, either way you look at it. But I remember that was like, that's one of those feeling I had highs and lows, ups and downs. And I look back on that and that was an amazing experience. It really was. Now I could have sat and ate cookies and watched Netflix and said, my hand hurts. But I just felt like, man, life is to be lived.
Yeah. And sometimes we get opportunities to play a different role. Sometimes God gives us a challenge that takes us out of the role of being the runner and the first finisher to the role of being the supporter and the funny guy that's encouraging people, right?
Yeah. Oh man. Okay. That's funny that you say that. So I almost feel like now is the big reveal. So what can I tell you something about this whole thing that we're talking about today?
Please.
So back in January, February, actually I hurt my knee playing basketball and I continued to run and run and run. And by about April, I ended up getting an MRI, x-rays, that sort of, and it turns out that I've got some damage done there. And so I have not been able to run for a little while. And, I even had to take a pretty significant amount of time off over the summer and put on a little bit of weight, which was, I've never done that before. Because I was still eating like an ultra marathon runner. And I've never talked about any of this, I have to tell you, Monica. And boy, talk about like a crisis of identity. Every time I'm recording the intro to my podcast, I'm talking about being an ultra marathon runner, that sort of thing. And then I started feeling good. I was like, okay, I think I'm ready to start making a comeback. And I literally had to start at quarter mile, half mile, 1 day a week, 2 days a week. And then all of a sudden that pain was back again. And that was only a few weeks ago. So, I am kind of starting to look at this like, all right, maybe it's my time to be in a different role. And maybe, it's my time to be more of the volunteer or the person who can encourage. Or I still like to think I found myself in my doctor's office being that guy that was like, I've run 150 ultra marathons, but as I sit there with knee pain and, had put on 15 pounds, I felt like he's thinking, yeah, right, champ, I bet you used to be a great high school, whatever too, that sort of thing. But so I appreciate you saying that though, because it is interesting to kind of sometimes look at those different roles. And now I'm at this point where I was telling my wife, I cannot wait to just even get back to doing anything in that realm of running. And I feel like it is going to be my time to be, I can be the slow guy who shuffles. Maybe I am the guy that is there just as people pass me trying to, make light of situations and just hopefully bring some joy to other people during a race or that sort of thing.
Yeah. Because you know what they need while they're running.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of where things are right now. So it's pretty interesting. I wasn't sure if I was going to bring that up or if I was going to continue it, but now I almost feel like I'm telling those, you know, those stories, right? You know, Monica, once when I ran this race, I was, you know, that sort of thing. So.
But it's, well, yeah. Talk for a second about the benefits of running or any type of sustained physical activity on our mental and emotional health. And then if that's not possible because of an injury or something like that, what are a few options that you can give people that are nursing an injury that they can still get that benefit, but not necessarily have to run?
No, exactly. And I almost feel like that's the part where I think if anything, this is really teaching me a great deal of empathy, which I like to think that I do fairly well with as a therapist, but you know, empathy toward those who really can't run or who maybe had been their identity in the past, because you know, there's so many different things that exercise will do. And there's so much data now that shows that it's a big factor of reducing, you know, chronic heart disease, and even weight bearing exercise it helps for our muscles and our bones and can extend the quality of our life. And there are things that have some nice studies that show that exercise in particular can have a similar effect of some antidepressants, you know, or so it really can boost our mood. I mean, it helps with our skin. It helps with our energy levels. I mean, it helps brain and memory. There's a lot of data that's starting to come out around things like Alzheimer's or dementia that talk about, you know, exercise being a pretty key component of being able to reduce the risks of those things. And those are things that frighten me. They really do. I mean, I'm getting old. So I want to do all that I can to maintain a healthy brain, a healthy, you know, to be active. I remember one of my goals early on was just being able to play basketball, which is funny because that's what maybe kind of might be the thing that took me out. But with my son, you know, as he got into prime basketball age. And so I think it's been about the last decade, I feel like I'm the only guy that's on the court that's over 40. And I've always just felt like, man, that's those benefits of exercise, because, you know, not just the physical benefits, but I love being the guy that's out there with my son. You know, I love being the guy that's out there with the young men and being able to talk with them and just be able to have that shared experience with them. So I feel like there's so many benefits, whether it's emotional, physical, you know, mental, it's community, it's these shared experiences, but there's just so many benefits to just physical exercise in general. So I've actually enjoyed, as the running part has not been viable for some reason, the way it actually happens to be my meniscus that I'm having some struggles with, but I can do the stair climber. And so I am really enjoying the stair climber. And every now and again, I start finding telling myself, okay, I'm going to do a 24-hour stair climber event, you know, and then I think, hey, how about I just get to the point where I can do it for a little while and just, you know, enjoy it. And I've started to do things like, you know, some of the CrossFit stuff or some of these things that I never really did before because I was a runner, and finding that there's a whole community. And I feel like in each one of these different avenues of fitness. And so it's given me an opportunity to interact with more people and try new things. And I never realized that different parts of my body could be as sore as my legs would be after 24 hours of running. And so there's a lot of different ways to still get those feelings, those endorphins. And so maybe that's why I needed this to happen right now, so I could understand that more.
Yeah. So after talking to you for a little bit, I don't know this for sure, but I'm thinking you're kind of a goals guy.
Well, so it's so funny. I think I always have been. And so, but I've recognized that, and if I go back to this acceptance and commitment therapy model, I think that one of the things that I love about what I'm learning the older I get is goals are amazing. And I'm never going to be a guy that's going to say, yeah, don't have goals. I mean, goals are. I've always liked to have another race because that's a goal. So the next race keeps me moving, keeps me active. But I'm starting to learn, and again, this is an acceptance and commitment therapy principle, but the hard part is a lot of times races are a little different. You know, you do hit that goal, you feel good, you get the t-shirt, you get the belt buckle, and then you say, what's next? But the goals, a lot of times that's when people say, all right, I'm going to set a goal that I'm going to make, you know, if I make 100 grand a year, I'll be happy. Then they make that goal and then they're like, okay, that didn't quite do it. Or I'm going to, you know, if I get the 6-pack abs, then I'll be happy. Or if I get the whatever car, then I'll be happy. So I do feel like sometimes those are those type of goals that I appreciate people setting because it does motivate. But I love this concept of maybe starting to identify values and live more by the values. And then goals are great. But then if my value really is fitness, or my value is connection, or my value is authenticity, or these sort of things, then those are what I'm going to kind of work the activities into, are those values. And I think that actually now you're having me process this live, Monica, this is well done. I think that is maybe why what I'm starting to appreciate more about, if my value is more of this fitness as a value, or connection with my wife as a value, then I'm just as happy to be. We've been going on really long, like old people walks on Sunday afternoons now when we've never done that. And I love it because there's fitness, there's movement, there's connection, there's talking, or the value of talking with people more at the gym, or those sort of things. So I think I owe you some money now for you being a therapist here right now. Right?
I'll bill you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so this episode's going to air right before the new year. Everyone listening is probably going to be thinking about their new year's resolutions, their goals, all of that. So in your talking about your values and your goals, give us a few tips to rock our goals in our marriage and with our mental health and with all of these things kind of in that value framework.
Okay, this is so good because I actually have a real experiment that I've done that worked in this regard. So last year I did a podcast on my virtual couch podcast and it was New Year's resolutions with acceptance and commitment therapy. So what that means, and I'm going to give the simplest one. If my, let's just say I'd place this value on fitness. So my goal was going to be to do pushups every day. Well, in the past I might've done, I want to get to the point where I can do a set of 100 pushups or one of these kind of goals, which sounds great, right? That sounds like a good goal. But then if you don't continually focus on that goal, or if you have days where you're down or days you don't get to it, that's where I feel like resolutions fall apart because then I beat myself up and I say, man, I couldn't even stick to this goal and I'm never going to get to one set of 100 pushups or whatever. If my value is exercise and or value is fitness, and even at the core of that is it's going to be whatever a value, stick-to-itiveness, or I'm going to do it this time as a value, I set the goal of doing pushups daily. Now at that point then, when people might feel like, well, that's not tangible enough. And I understand that, but I'm trying to figure out a way to then not give my brain the, see, you couldn't even do that story to fuse onto. So for, it was like a several months. I mean, it might've just been one set of 20 pushups or one set of 25 pushups. And then I would even, my brain would say, that's not even that many. Well, I'm not in acceptance and commitment therapy. Our brain's trying to hook us or fuse us to these stories that really are about the path of least resistance. And we're not even debating if that story is true or false. So true or false, 20 or 25 pushups is not a whole lot. I mean, okay, fine. But we're not even debating if that's a true or false story. My goal was to do pushups every day. So I found that the more I was doing that, the more that I wasn't beating myself up, the more that I was starting to kind of feel like, hey, doing pushups every day is good. And look at this. Now I've got quite a few days that I've been doing this, even if it's 5, I don't even care. And then I feel like it took 2 or 3 months, but then my brain, I felt like finally said, fine, do your pushups. You know, so now it's to the point where there are days where it might be 200 or 300 or more than I'd ever done in my entire life in sets between clients. But I just felt like, you know, my brain finally defused from this, hey, that's not enough, or blew it, or those kind of stories that they do. So I love this concept of acceptance and commitment therapy with resolutions, New Year's resolutions. Because if you can build a New Year's resolution that is based on your values, you know, of whatever is really important to you, not what society says should be important to you, but what really you feel at your core, and then set, it doesn't have to be I'm going to do 15 of these a day. If that's the way you work, great, but just make room in there for, and if I don't, I'm not going to fuse to the man, you blew it story, or you might as well give up story, because those are what, if your brain hooks you on that, remember, that's just a thought, but now we fuse and believe to that thought, and now we're off the hook. We don't have to keep trying. So that's the part where I feel like New Year, for your resolutions, if it's to communicate with my partner more, that's a great place to start. And that just might mean that we're going to text something every day, or we're going to try to, you know, Marco Polo or Snapchat or whatever. We're going to do whatever we can to have connection, but we're not going to say we have to sit down and talk for 15 minutes every day, because guess what? Things are going to get in the way. Life's going to get in the way. And then we're going to all of a sudden feel like, well, see, I blew that. So, you know, just start kind of giving yourself ways to succeed. You need some small victories. And I feel like the key to that is doing it on your values and then not turn yourself up about if you aren't able to nail that perfectly every time.
I love that. Let's get that episode number and we'll go there. So let's from last year. Perfect. Okay. So as we're going to switch gears here as we close a little bit, and I'm going to ask you some more personal questions. If your children were describing their dad, what do you hope stands out to them about you?
Okay. This is a big one. Man, I almost get teary. I think of this one. I was at a church training a long time ago, and there was a guy named L. Tom Perry, and it was his son was in our area. And he said this thing where he said, I never saw my dad have a bad day. And I just remember thinking, wow. And again, this is my value. You know, I know that people are human and they have bad days and that sort of thing, but I'm a pretty upbeat guy. I still have a lot of the demons in my brain, the stories my brain's trying to hook me or fuse me to. But I just wanted my kids to feel that same way. And I feel like, you know, I just always wanted to be that guy that they can go to and that I'm going to say, hey, tell me what you're going through. Tell me what that's like. I've got a couple of episodes that I've had one of my daughters on who struggle with some episodes of depression. And I try with my kids to just, you know, I just want to listen. I'm going to lay down on their floor. I'm going to just like let them play their music in the car and then just talk to them. And I just want to hear them. I'm not going to try to lecture them. I'm not going to try to tell them stories about when I was a kid right out of the gate. I want them to feel like I'm somebody that cares and that they can just go to. And I now hear often where they get to say the things like they can always, you know, they feel like their dad doesn't have really a bad day. And I know, again, I don't want anybody to feel guilt or shame that is not core to who they are. But for me, that's what I just have always wanted my kids to feel, that they can come to me, talk to me about anything, that I'm going to be up for them. And I feel, I hope that that's been something that I've been able to do.
I love it. If you had the undivided attention of everyone in the entire world for just a few minutes, what is the most important thing you could teach them about improving their health, either physically, mentally, or emotionally?
Okay, let's go with, I mean, the physical, I would say the things we've talked about with, you know, don't fuse to the I blew it or I can't do it stories. You know, I big time. But the emotional, the mental, listen. Just stop and listen. Listen to people. Be empathetic. Don't rush to judgment. Our brains immediately think of, what am I going to say next? That is a skill that has to be practiced. First day of grad school to be a therapist, I remember they had us pair off with somebody and sit and just have them talk and listen and not try to figure out what we were going to say next. And it was difficult. And I feel like at the core of couples therapy, of working with teenagers, you name it, we just want to be heard. You know, we want to be heard. And there's a Stephen Covey principle from business, which is the seek first to understand and then be understood before being understood. And I feel like that is one of the key principles that I wish we could all kind of understand, is that we all want to be heard. We all have our own reasons why we want to say something or ask something. And so I feel like one of the most difficult things that we do is when we don't even hear someone. Somebody says, even if it's a simple thing of, man, I don't feel like I look very good in this outfit. And even if we immediately say, yeah, you do, let's hear them. I mean, why do you feel that way? You know, what does that outfit bring up for you? And I mean, we just want to be heard. And if we feel heard and validated, that's when we might be willing to kind of move more toward, I don't know, maybe I'm being oversensitive, or what do you think about it? But when we say that, we're not saying, hey, everybody, give me all your opinions right away. You know, we really want to be heard. So that's kind of what I would say.
Awesome. All right. Well, in closing, tell the listeners where they can find you. Make sure you include your podcast in there. Tell us about your book, and we'll make sure we link to all of it.
Yeah, you're very kind. I'm a horrible promoter. So you can go to tonyoverbay.com, and I'm trying to get better about my mailing list. I will never spam you. As a matter of fact, up to this point, I pretty much never emailed you, but I'm getting better at that. And then also I've got an online pornography addiction recovery program called The Path Back. You can find that at pathbackrecovery.com. And the podcast, which I absolutely love, which I need to have you on mine, is The Virtual Couch. And I think about episode 170 something, and it's been 2.5 years, and it's just been I love it. I love doing it. I love the people that I get to interview. I love the feedback that I receive from it. And the book that just came out is one called He's a Porn Addict, Now What? An Expert and a Former Addict Answer Your Questions. And it's not I lightheartedly joke about it. It's not a page-turning John Grisham-like legal thriller, which I really enjoy. But it's a book that was presented to me by a gentleman named Joshua Shea, who wrote a book about his addiction. And there's nothing like it. We took 8 chapters of questions about addiction, and we didn't see what the other person wrote. And I answered the questions from the role of an expert. He answered them from the role of an addict. And it's pretty phenomenal. I mean, it's available on Amazon. And if you just go look at the professional reviews, I mean, it's one of those, again, imposter syndrome galore, but where there's a lot of nice people with lots of neat letters behind their names and lots of experience that are saying that there's nothing like that, that kind of shows what it's like as the addict and what it's like as the betrayed. And boy, talk about empathy. I think reading both sides of that, I think it helps understand each person better. So I would encourage people to go take a look at that.
Me too. Okay. So we'll link to all of that in the show notes. Tony, thank you so much for
your time. Thank you. I'm so glad we did this.
In this busy season, it was so fun to be able to catch you and do this. And
if it's not the new year, then you need to come on mine. Okay.
Done.
Okay.
I just love Tony and the work that he's doing in the world, and it's always such a pleasure to chat with him. What a wonderful way to finish out 2019 and move into 2020. I love his take on setting goals and the way he advises us to do it. So I hope that when you're all coming up with your New Year's resolutions, that you will consider his strategy. And I will link to his podcast episode about it in the show notes. So make sure you give that a listen. We will be changing things up a little bit in 2020. Of course, we're going to keep our emphasis on marriage, but we're also going to put a really strong emphasis on health. So I thought this episode was a great way to merge the two. Next week, we're going to be hearing from the incredible Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife. She is going to be talking all about goal setting in the new year. So no matter what your goals are for 2020, just remember to have courage, be kind, and stay on the brighter side.